Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a hair-raising off-road experience, we've got three guests today. Neil Sagal will tell us about the persistence of slaveholder wealth by a look at members of Congress. Emily Jasinski will offer a conservative's view of the election. And Melissa Arnold-Lyon will analyze the effects of teacher strikes. Time is tight, so only a few words from me. Some people have a hard time accepting the fact that slavery has left a very durable mark in American society. Here's further evidence that it has. My first guest, Neil Sagal, a graduate student in computer science at the University of Pennsylvania, is a co-author, along with his father, Ashwini Sagal, an MD who does research at Case Western Reserve, of a paper showing that members of Congress who have slaveholders in their family history are substantially richer than those that didn't. Aside from a story about the durability of slavery, it's also a story about the durability of wealth. Neil Sagal. First, how'd you go about this work? What were the information sources?
We kind of relied on two data sets that had been compiled by journalists. One was this report from Reuters, which was kind of the inspiration for the study in the first place. Last year, Reuters did this big report where they took all of the congresspeople in the Congress session for 2021 to 2023, and they basically did this big report on who was and who wasn't a descendant of slaveholders. And they did this by looking at census records and a lot of other historical records. They had genealogists help them verify everything. And they basically identified that 100 out of the 535 Congress members were direct descendants of slaveholders. And then separately, we needed to combine this with data on wealth. And so Congress members are required to disclose their finances annually, but they do this in a way where it's hard for people to access the data. It's publicly available, but it's not, you know, in one nicely clean data set. And so Business Insider a number of years ago also did a similar deep dive where they read through all the disclosures and put it all together in one data set. And so we took these two data sets and combined them.
Now let's talk some about the findings. First of all, how do members of Congress compare to the general public? I'm guessing they're richer.
Yeah, so Congress members are definitely a unique subset of the population. You know, they're elected to represent all Americans. So in some sense, they represent all Americans, but they definitely don't look like all Americans. Their median net worth is around $1.3 million. That's definitely not the median net worth of most Americans. And so they're a really unique subset of the population. And so it makes it hard to extrapolate anything that we see here among members of Congress to the general population.
And before we get to their ancestry, the relation of wealth among Congress members to demographic characteristics like age, education, and race were no surprise, right? It just conforms to one's expectations.
Yeah, so I think the findings overall tracked with what you would expect, but they're definitely a unique population.
Okay, and so what did having slave owners in your past do to your wealth for a congressperson?
Yeah, so we found that members of Congress who were descendants of large slaveholders had a median net worth that was about five times larger than members of Congress who had no slaveholder ancestry. And this was even after accounting for their age, their race, their sex, and education level. And we think this shows how the economic advantages of slavery still impact us today.
And the number of slaves held by their ancestors mattered, right?
Yeah, so there is kind of a relationship between if you had just an ancestor who just had one slave versus 16 or more. And so it was really this group that had 16 or more, these large slaveholders, where there was the largest effect. And so you can imagine someone who owned one to five slaves 250 years ago, that's not someone who was as wealthy as someone who owned 16 or more slaves. And so we found the largest effect among this group that was large slaveholders.
Some broader historical questions here. With emancipation, slave owners experienced one of the largest wealth expropriations in history, but they and their descendants recovered pretty quickly. How did they do that?
Yeah, so for a number of years, especially in the 1900s, the common view was that emancipation kind of devastated these families. It was one of the largest contractions in wealth in history. And so the conventional wisdom, this was supported by historians, was that these families were devastated, but this notion that they were devastated has kind of been pushed back in recent years. And so there was this great paper in 2016 from some economists where they looked at large slaveholders before emancipation, and they also looked at people who were equally wealthy in the South but weren't slaveholders, but they were equally wealthy. And they basically found that the grandsons of these large slaveholders in 1940, they kind of completely bounced back in earnings. So this suggested that just, you know, in two generations, these families bounced back. And this specific paper, they got into the mechanisms for how these families bounced back. And what they found was that it wasn't education or ability that led to them bouncing back. It really was access to elite connections, access to elite social networks and marriages to other elite families. And then there's also a lot of other things that let slaveholders in the South recover financially after emancipation. So things like convict leasing, which is renting out prisoners for cheap labor, sharecropping, which is allowing former slaves to farm land in exchange for a share of the crops, often under unfair conditions. And then laws and practices like Jim Crow also kept Black Americans disenfranchised economically well into the 20th century.
And you say in the paper, studies have found that counties with higher rates of slavery in 1860 are associated with higher contemporary levels of racial inequality. Yeah, could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, so a lot of the previous research before our paper was looking at county-level studies. They weren't really looking at individual slaveholders and their individual descendants. And so basically what they showed is that there's connections between historical rates of slavery and contemporary socioeconomic outcomes like income and home ownership. And so one study found that white people in counties with higher rates of slavery, when you compared that to white people in southern counties with lower rates of slavery, white people in counties with higher rates of slavery have better socioeconomic outcomes today. A lot of other papers have done similar work at the county level. So they found that U.S. counties in the past exhibited a higher slave share over the population, turn out to still be more unequal in terms of Black-white inequality in the present day. So there's been a lot of work at the county level showing that these disparities have persisted.
Now, this research, it's interesting in at least two dimensions. One is the persistence of slavery's effects on American society today. They remain extremely profound, 170 years later.
I was definitely surprised by the magnitude of the wealth disparity linked to slaveholding ancestry that we found. And yet it definitely reinforces the idea that history and historical injustices have long-term economic consequences. So I was surprised by the magnitude, but I would say that the overall result tracks with past work on the durability of wealth over time. So even though we're looking at slavery and slaveholders, just looking at the past work that has looked at how durable wealth is, the findings aren't that surprising.
And finally, we hear a lot of talk about the intergenerational transmission of poverty, but we don't hear so much about the intergenerational transmission of wealth. But that's a profound thing and explains a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of research, especially on the legacy of slavery, where they look at the negative effects that it had on Black Americans. But there's been a lot less research looking at the positive effects it's had on certain individuals and certain families. But there is a lot of research, again, on the durability of wealth and not just the durability of poverty. And so I think one study that really stood out to me came a few years ago where these economists looked at the wealthiest families in Florence, Italy in 2011. And they had tax records in 2011, and they also had tax records going all the way back to 1427. And what they found was that the wealthiest families in Florence in 2011 were also, on average, the wealthiest families in 1427, 700 years before that. These findings have been repeated in Sweden and Italy and the U.S., all across the world. And so there is a lot of research, again, showing that wealth perpetuates and status perpetuates. And it's not just that poverty is persistent across generations often, but wealth is too.
That was Neil Sagal, a graduate student in computer science at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author, along with his father, Ashwini Sagal, of a paper on the durability of slaveholder wealth. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of Domenico Scarlatti's keyboard sonata K334, performed by Scott Ross. Next, a conservative's view of the election. Emily Jasinski has been on this show several times before, and I thought it would be interesting to hear a view from the right on this presidential campaign. She's the Washington editor of Unheard and co-host, along with Ryan Grimm, of Counterpoints. Emily Jasinski. What do you make of Liz and Dix, which is a pairing of names that once had a very different meaning, but also works with the U-lines, I guess, too. But what do you make of their endorsement of Harris?
You know, I was actually just talking to a friend about this, and I say that because I don't want to totally steal their point, but I think it's the right one, which is Marshall Kosloff over at The Realignment was saying this is fundamentally about Donald Trump. And his point was this isn't necessarily about war. It's not necessarily about immigration or entitlements on the policy front. It's really just that their beef is fundamentally with Donald Trump over the question of January 6th, that this is about Donald Trump's character, not about broader questions of populism. They were willing to stomach all of those broader issues of populism. They didn't like it. Clearly, you could tell in their public statements, they didn't like it around 2016. But Liz Cheney was happy to go out there and keep saying, I think Donald Trump is the best person for the job until January 6th. And after that, both of them broke with the party pretty fundamentally. And so it does seem like this is just a fundamentally a personality clash more than like a broader rejection of populism. Even though they do reject it, they were still kind of willing to go along with it for the sake of, I would argue, their power, their access to power in the Republican Party until January 6th. So that's my take on it. But it is absolutely hilarious, I think, also to watch so many, you know, sort of mainstream Democrats or mainstream journalists suddenly take lectures on lowercase d democracy from Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney.
Really? Well, no, I remember when Democrats, or at least some of them, just hated Dick in particular. And now to see them welcoming this endorsement, it's just wild.
Yeah, I did a little trip down memory lane and was Googling Dick Cheney with war criminal this morning to see where are these like actual, I mean, some real mainstream outlets were absolutely having the conversation about whether Dick Cheney was an actual war criminal. And we go back to conversations about Abu Ghraib. There's a clear willingness to discuss whether this man was a threat to democracy back then. And that is utterly absent from the conversation right now.
Now, what about bellicosity? Is some of the attraction for the people like the Cheneys to Harris that she's probably more likely to stick with NATO and Ukraine and all this business? How much is that important to them?
Totally. I think that's extremely important to them. And, you know, Liz Cheney was calling Kamala Harris a, quote, radical liberal when she was a Republican member of Congress. So I think it makes her more comfortable that this, quote, radical liberal is aligned with her, even if they're not in alignment on questions of like the size and scope of government. You know, Liz Cheney calls herself a limited government conservative. When people used to ask her if she was a Trump conservative or a Cheney conservative, she'd say, I'm a Liz Cheney limited government conservative. So even if they're not in alignment on what she long said was such an important issue, and we could have a conversation about whether limited governments would support the bloated Pentagon budget, but that's for another topic. But the thing that makes her comfortable not just sitting the election out or telling other people to set the elections up, but to actually proactively go vote for Kamala Harris, I think probably is that she's not really worried that Kamala Harris will hedge on Israel. She's not really worried Kamala Harris will depart from her policy on Ukraine or her preferred policy on Ukraine. So I think that's absolutely central to them, not just sitting it out, but actually proactively voting for Harris.
Along with some strange bedfellows like the Cheneys, Trump has picked up some curiosities along the way, like Tulsi and Bobby Jr. What do you make of them?
Yeah, it's interesting because it gets to what the Republican Party after Donald Trump would look like. And would Bobby Kennedy potentially endorse a J.D. Vance? You know, say J.D. Vance is at the head of the ticket. It's very strange to have Donald Trump right now being, you know, surrounded by both Mike Pompeo and Bobby Kennedy Jr., Tulsi Gabbard and Mike Pompeo, or Keith Kellogg and some others, where there's just a fundamental contrast and actually a antipathy, let's say, between Bobby Kennedy and Mike Pompeo. So who wins that war in the long term? Is an RFK Jr. or an RFK Jr. voter going to stick around the Republican Party if after Donald Trump, the standard bearer is Mike Pompeo. What about if it's J.D. Vance? I mean, J.D. Vance actually is willing to go outside of the typical boundaries of the Republican Party. But would that be true after Trump? Like, these questions are really interesting, but I also feel like we just have no idea because we have no idea what happens. You know, we have some indications, but we don't know under what circumstances Donald Trump will exit the political stage, when that would happen. It's just so hard to say. And I feel like all of that will determine where the public is and where the Republican Party then goes in the future. There's some signs that there's real change, but I don't know how durable it is.
And what about the influence of Project 2025? Trump denies all, but that's kind of hard to accept. What do you see of the role of that document in the Trump movement and the Republican Party more broadly?
You know, I think if Democrats hadn't sort of made an issue of Project 2025, it would have been a lot more influential than it will be now. Because what I've picked up from the Trump campaign is that Trump himself is personally furious. The Heritage Foundation was fundraising off of this document and was basically presenting it to the media as something that was a real concrete plan, because Donald Trump didn't have any control over what was going on in Project 2025. His advisors, once and potentially future, definitely did. I mean, there's certainly overlap between the people who were working on the project and the people who would be in a second Trump administration. But I think because Heritage got ahead of its skis as far as Trump saw it, Trump now wants absolutely nothing to do with Project 2025. And it could actually hurt some of those guys' ability to get hired in a second Trump administration. I don't think Trump has much choice. I think he'll probably have to hire some of those guys. And now they've set out, you know, they've actually put pen to paper and said, this is my preferred policy. If Donald Trump is elected president, there will be some influence. There's no question about it. But I actually think it's diminished based on where it would have been if the Harris campaign didn't make it an issue.
But it's not like Trump learned much about the mechanics of governance after his 4 years in office or the 4 years out. So I guess he's going to need people like that to run the show.
Which is what Heritage was thinking. I mean, that was exactly the mentality of the Heritage Foundation when they said, we actually want to sit down, put this to paper, because when Donald Trump came in office in 2017 and sat down in the Oval Office, we didn't have conservatives, didn't have a plan for what we wanted Republicans to do going forward. We were totally caught off guard. We didn't realize that you would have to gut the administrative agencies in order to, you know, have the agenda that you want, the conservative agenda at the EPA. We were getting hampered at every turn, undermined at every turn. And so, you know, before you do anything with the EPA, you have to fire a bunch of people at the EPA. That was totally the mentality. It was on day one, what is a Republican president, whether it's Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump, going to actually do? We want him to have ideas. That was how they thought of it.
Well, that's what they did for Reagan, as I recall. I guess they're trying to repeat those glory days by writing the manual.
And if you go back to the 80s, there are hilarious attacks on the Reagan administration from Heritage and Cato people because the Reagan administration didn't abolish the Department of Education by 1984. There's some real echoes.
Okay, J.D. Vance, help or hurt?
That's a good question. I don't think vice presidents help or hurt in the aggregate. That's just sort of my take in general. If I had to say whether J.D. Vance is helping or hurting, I would say he's probably hurting, because I think fundamentally abortion is going to be a huge help for Democrats just politically in this election cycle. And because he has now become that sort of caricature of J.D. Vance, maybe it's not a caricature, but that, you know, cartoonish idea of J.D. Vance as, you know, the cat lady, that idea of him as this man who wants to control women's bodies and wants to be this sort of religious extremist, because he was kind of talking like a religious extremist in a lot of podcasts, random podcasts before he even ran for Senate. I think when that image was solidified in the minds of a lot of voters, that was a pretty fundamental, for a lot of people, glimpse at what they expect from a Trump-Vance administration. So for women in places like Michigan, suburban Detroit, suburban Milwaukee, I think that's a big deal just in terms of whether they even decide to vote. Maybe they would have voted for Trump before. Or maybe they stay home now.
What about Vance's ties to, I don't know what we want to call them, the new right, the post-liberals, the anti-Democrats like Curtis Yarvin and raw egg nationalists at the extremes? But, you know, somebody like Peter Thiel is a much more substantial figure than either of those. Is Vance somehow their protege or their puppet or what?
You know, it's a good question. And it's an open question, I think, because Vance has had to really, obviously he's Trump's vice president, but he's had to really become in like lockstep with Donald Trump over the course of the last 2 months. And so I tend to think Donald Trump has much more influence over J.D. Vance than Yarvin or Thiel does. I mean, now we definitely see him. The reason he was talking in a way that sounded like maybe religious extremism to a lot of people before he ran for Senate is because he was talking more freely as an acolyte of Yarvin and Thiel and people who do have some sort of openly, admittedly extreme ideas about American culture and politics. So I think that's where we see him totally discarding with that rhetoric tells me at least that Donald Trump is the audience of one he's performing for at this point. Now, if Donald Trump wasn't the president, if J.D. Vance just stepped into office, he wrote this very long essay for The Lamp, a Catholic magazine, before he ran for Senate about his conversion to Catholicism. And it's clearly sincere. It's very, very detailed. And I think he is sincerely of that milieu. He is a fellow traveler of the Yarvins and the Thiels. He may have a slightly more orthodox conservative perspective than them, but those are the sort of ideological waters that he swims in. So if he were to become president, something were to happen to Donald Trump and he were to become president, I think actually you could expect to see some things from that world make their way into the policy space.
Thiel has said he's skeptical about democracy. Yarvin is a monarchist.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Trump says something like, there'll never be another election again. He just feeds speculation that maybe he has, you know, dictatorial fantasies. How can we reconcile this? Is like Vance going to provide the theory for a Trumpian autocratic practice?
It is an interesting question because Vance didn't seem to really dabble in where Yarvin was going with the monarchy. But there was that Patrick Deneen book that is foundational for the new right. It was called Why Liberalism Failed. And it was actually on Barack Obama's summer reading list 1 year. I do think J.D. Vance believes that there are fundamental flaws in the liberal design, the liberal political design. And
liberal meaning very broadly.
Small L, yeah. Right. Yeah. Like the Republican system of government, small r,
yeah.
Republican system of government, because that's a really popular line of thinking among, you know, Rod Dreher, who's definitely somebody who helps push J.D. Vance onto the political scene, Orthodox writer, and Patrick Deneen and others in that sort of Catholic space that Vance travels in. He spoke at the National Conservatism Conference earlier this year. I don't know if J.D. Vance would go full Trump when Mike Pence was pushed to go full Trump literally on January 6th. I actually think that's a really interesting question because I don't know the answer of what J.D. Vance would do, except that I know that J.D. Vance, you know, he indicated what he thought about that and he has since. And I know that he does travel in those circles and he believes that there are fundamental flaws to liberalism. But that's an open question. I mean, is he at the same time, you know, he's travels in circles now with some really normal Republican donors and types that might be pressuring him to act more like Mike Pence in a situation like that. So that's one of the things that's somewhat frightening about the Trump moment is you just don't know how people are going to react and you don't know what circumstances are going to pop up that we can't even anticipate the reactions within.
I'm speaking with Emily Jashinsky, DC editor for Unheard. Parenthetically, the prominence of Catholics on the right these days is something that's very disturbing to me as someone who grew up that way and still has a lingering fondness for the religion. Vance is a path for that kind of Catholic reaction to enter the mainstream, it seems.
Oh, totally. I mean, he absolutely is a vehicle for like post-liberal Catholic thought. And, you know, that's interesting in some ways because one of the things we see those thinkers really emphasize is community and family and, you know, taking care of people around you. And it couldn't be compared to the sort of Bush era compassionate conservatism, but there's a real emphasis genuinely on where the Republican Party has been less than compassionate and how that can be sort of made up. And it goes in different directions, of course. That could go in a really bad sort of politics of white grievance direction, or it could go in a really positive direction where you see J.D. Vance genuinely, or Josh Hawley, who's not Catholic, but evangelical, you know, going to the picket lines, marching with striking workers. And, you know, again, there's very legitimate questions about how sincere they are.
Well, it's funny when Marcy Kaptur said first time, right? And Vance said, yeah.
Yes, I remember that. And, you know, that's the PRO Act has become sort of a litmus test. That's a piece of legislation that would get rid of right to work. And it's supported by all of the unions that J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley are trying to make common cause with. But there's something even more interesting just than that going on. It's about them realizing corporate power fundamentally has not been pro-family, pro-community. I'm optimistic about those guys, where that can go. I don't know that it ends up going in a good direction fundamentally, but I'm at least optimistic about it because they have been, a lot of their ties with, say, the Chamber of Commerce have been like obliterated. That is real. I mean, I've talked to people in those circles. Like, they actually have lost some, the Chamber of Commerce and some corporate interests have really lost access to Republican politicians because of some of these bitter feuds. So that's a good thing. Where it ends up, still an open question.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. Whatever happened to the Wall Street Republicans? We have some like Schwartzman still going for Trump, but how widespread is that? Don't they like stability and predictability? And Trump is the very opposite of that.
Yeah, it's. I wonder if what we're going to see this election cycle is Wall Street go for Harris and Silicon Valley go for Trump. And that's just in the aggregate sense, you know, who gives most money to one candidate versus the other. I think we're going to see a close to 50-50 split when all is said and done in terms of where the money went, both in Silicon Valley and in Wall Street.
You mean big money or...
Yeah, so like campaign donations to Trump, which is interesting in and of itself because Harris, watching Mark Cuban try to explain, or Reid Hoffman try to explain that Kamala Harris isn't actually serious about like somewhat populist, somewhat progressive economic policies that she's talked about in the past. She's not actually serious about Medicare for All. She's not actually serious about taxing capital gains. It's somewhat amusing. And it seems to actually also be working, that this is genuinely persuading other people on Wall Street that the predictability and stability that you would get with Kamala Harris is better than them supporting Donald Trump, even though one of his first things that he did after being elected was say, we're bringing in the CEO of Exxon and these guys from Goldman Sachs to run the government. It's a real tug of war right now in both of those industries. So that's interesting, I think, in and of itself.
Well, the Fortune 500 CEO class has also been largely absent. I don't think they've contributed anything, or last I saw, they hadn't really contributed anything to either candidate. They might find the chaos off-putting too, like Wall Street would. But on the other hand, tax cuts and deregulation can win a lot of executive hearts. So where do you see the big corporate class going?
Right. The Harris campaign says they're getting rid of the Trump tax cut. The Trump campaign says it's going to extend the Trump tax cut. So you'd think that would be enough to get a lot of CEOs in line with Trump, especially as I think there are some people in the business class that are making it more and more acceptable just socially to support Donald Trump. At the same time, though, I think it also speaks to how confident people like Reid Hoffman and the people who take a lot of their sort of political weather reports from Reid Hoffman, how confident they are that they would have access to a Harris administration, that they would be able to, you know, influence any type of legislation about, let's say, capital gains or corporate tax cuts. Maybe they get a little something else, even if she raises corporate taxes. Where does she give them what they want? Does she get rid of Lina Khan? I think there's a real confidence among Reid Hoffman, Mark Cuban, and others, just because they've been given seemingly a direct line to the Harris campaign, that they would have intense sway, and that makes them a lot more comfortable with Kamala Harris.
Insofar as Biden represented something of a departure from neoliberalism, Harris seems to be leaning back in that direction.
Right. Yes, I agree with that. She does seem to be. And at the same time, there's this intense, you know, tug of war, just in the same way we were talking about with the Republican Party. There's this intense tug of war over Lina Khan that's playing out in public view right now. Obviously, Lina Khan at the FTC, who has spearheaded a lot of the kind of anti-neoliberal, like true merger crackdowns that we've seen from the Biden administration. So, I mean, I don't think Kamala Harris would have been a champion of the legislation that Biden passed if she was the president herself. I don't know that she actually would have gone as far as he did in pushing for everything that he got in both of those massive pieces of legislation, just because she is personally so close to a lot of business interests, and not just old credit card companies like Biden, but like new big businesses. Uber, for example, she has very close ties to Uber. She has very close ties to a lot of those big California companies, a lot of ties to Wall Street. She's done the Hamptons fundraising circuit recently. She's a newer politician, too. She's less of an established entity like Joe Biden, or quantity like Joe Biden is. So I just think she's more open to being blown in the direction of the political winds.
But I can't imagine that any serious financier or corporate executive would be able to tolerate large tariffs.
Right. No, I agree. And you know, that's something she has to, I'm sure, behind closed doors. It's such a good point. I'm sure behind closed doors, she's having to defend what the Biden administration did, the Biden-Harris administration did, because I doubt she actually, I mean, it's just hard to see Kamala Harris being a serious champion of the Biden era China tariffs in the way that Biden actually has openly and eagerly defended them. You hear so little about it from her. And maybe that's a question, you know, she'll have to start answering, but you're hearing nothing. Biden was pretty proud of that. You're hearing basically nothing about it from Kamala Harris. And I think that gets to your point. What would she actually do, given how many conversations she's having with Cuban and Hoffman and those guys? I doubt she's going to continue those.
But Trump, he's talking about gigantic tariffs.
Yes. 10%. Then I think he increased the potential 10% figure too. I mean, yeah, huge.
He just loves those grand gestures. Something like tariffs appeal to him because they're simple, blunt instruments that he can impose with executive orders. And I can't imagine the corporate class would be very happy with that.
This brings me to actually what we were talking about with Kamala Harris as well. I do think there are a lot of people in the corporate class who see him as malleable because, again, he talked this huge game about China, about immigration, about all of these different policy issues when he was running for president in 2016. Then he brings in Steve Mnuchin and Rex Tillerson and passes a really orthodox, like limited government Republican tax cut bill. And that was like the big thing that he did in his administration was a tax cut bill. So I think they see him as someone that they can, like they do Kamala Harris, negotiate with. And, you know, he was so hard on DACA in his campaign. And then when he was negotiating with Nancy Pelosi at one point, he said, I will give you DACA if you, I think it was over the border wall, if you vote to build the border wall. In a similar way, I think a lot of people see Kamala Harris as somebody because she has held so many different positions that in a sense they can be talked to. They can be accessed by special interests and big donors. And that might be what makes them more comfortable with him.
But you don't buy the possibility of mass deportations?
That's a good question. I just don't know that they are able to make it feasible from a policy perspective. I know they have ideas about how I know Stephen Miller and people have ideas about how it would be feasible from a policy perspective, but Donald Trump is also so sensitive, weirdly sensitive sometimes, not always, but sometimes to public opinion, especially on those big narrative questions of whether he's compassionate or whether he's harsh and bigoted or whatever. Sometimes he doubles down and then sometimes he says, everyone's going to have health care. You know, it's just he's such a wild card. I just don't know that they would actually be able to land on a policy that when you go and put pen to paper, you sign a executive order or whatever it is, you're actually able to have the dominoes fall in the way that they want them to. So I'm sure people like Stephen Miller, who would be in a second Trump administration, are entirely sincere about it. I just don't know that they'd be able to make it happen.
And finally, we're recording this the day before the great debate, which may have some effects, but how do you handicap the race now?
I think it's a dead heat, actually. I think the Trump people underestimate how profoundly disliked he is by such a wide swath of the public. So I think they think just because the economy, as they see it, was better under Donald Trump, that that's a huge advantage going in. But I think they're underestimating how many people out there just genuinely cannot bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump. And Kamala Harris makes it a lot easier than voting for Joe Biden. You know, voting against Trump is an easier kind of pill to swallow. That said, a lot of people feel like they don't know Kamala Harris. There's still like significant chunk of undecided voters in swing states, according to some recent polls. And if the Trump campaign is able to message successfully that she is a threat, a danger, that she is the, quote, radical liberal, or I think he's been calling her like Comrade Kamala. If you're able to make that stick, maybe you've got a shot. But yeah, I think basically we're right now in a battle over who can turn out voters in the cities of those swing states and who can persuade voters in the suburbs of those swing states.
And not much time left.
That's right. Oh my gosh. It's crazy how little time is left at this point.
That's Emily Jashinsky, DC editor for Unheard and co-host along with Ryan Grimm of Counterpoints. We talk some about the anti-democratic views of Peter Thiel, the purportedly libertarian Silicon Valley mogul and funder of a lot of right-wing politics. Here's Thiel making his case from a conversation with the allegedly libertarian economist Tyler Cowen for something post-democratic.
One way to think of the Weimar period was, I don't know, it's like the dwarves in Moria where they dwelled too deep and, you know, finally they awakened the nameless terror of the Balrog. But I think there are, and again, I don't think we're ever in a cyclical world, but there are certainly certain parallels in the U.S. in the 2020s to Germany in the 1920s, where, you know, liberalism is exhausted. One suspects that democracy, whatever that means, is exhausted, and we have to ask some questions very far outside the Overton window.
That was Peter Thiel. Two things leap out here. First, how much he sees the world through the lens of the Lord of the Rings. A number of his company's names are lifted from Tolkien, and he evidently derives allegories of daily life from this series as well. And second, how sympathetic the nominally libertarian Thiel is to fascism. But scratch a libertarian and you often find an authoritarian. Freedom in this worldview means freedom for elites. And now the teacher strikes. Why did teachers strike, and what effect do those strikes have on teachers and students? Here with some answers is Melissa Arnold-Lyon, assistant professor of public policy at the University of Albany and co-author of a new National Bureau of Economic Research working paper on those topics. Melissa Arnold-Lyon. You logged some time as a middle school teacher before you entered academia, higher education. How did that affect your perspective on doing this research?
Yes, you're right. I mean, it totally shaped my thinking. I was a sixth grade reading teacher and then an instructional coach in Houston, Texas. And it was really, really tough for me. And I felt very powerless in the face of the stark realities of what it was to teach sixth grade and to teach period in Houston at the time. So I decided to go to graduate school so that I could try to understand that, so that I could try to develop research that would help us to have educational systems that would be more equitable for students and for teachers also.
Teachers seem to be very both underpaid and underappreciated.
Yes. This paper follows a previous paper that was just accepted at top education journal, AERJ, American Educational Research Journal, where one of my co-authors on this paper, Matthew Kraft, and I, we were tracing the state of the teaching profession over the past 15 years using about 18 different data sets. It's a very different paper, a big picture, descriptive, historical paper. And across all of these different data sets we see, and different ways of thinking about the state of the profession, we see a really stark decline in the profession since about 2010.
By what metrics?
Our four categories in that paper are teacher prestige, student interest in teaching, teacher preparation, and teacher job satisfaction. And then for each of those, we have a few different data sources because it's hard to find data that really covers the whole past 50 years. So we bring together many, many different data sets.
Yeah, it does seem that the schools are real centers of political conflict, and as political polarization has worsened over the years, teachers are very much at the center of that firestorm.
Yes, and I think many of them don't want to be.
Yes, you just want to teach kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so the paper. Teachers are a large workforce and very unionized. Could you give us some details on that?
Absolutely. And I think that's a great way to start because teachers are really important, not just for what they do for students, but also I think it's important to remember that teachers are an important part of our workforce and they're an important part of our middle class. So public school teachers are about 5% of the college educated workforce. There are over 3.7 million teachers nationally. Roughly one in five union members, so 18% of union members, are public school teachers. And they've also been, from what tracking we do have, a big part of the recent increases in strikes.
Now, they've been very unionized, but the density is falling over the decades, right?
Right, that's correct. And I think that's something that we include in the paper that honestly even surprised us, because I feel like not many people have been bringing this up, but we're using sort of top-notch federal data, just quick descriptive to look at the percent of teachers that are unionized. And it has been falling, and more than we expect. In 1990, 85% of public school teachers report their union members. Then that falls to 79% by 1999. And then when we look at 2020, it's down to 68%. So quite a bit of a decrease since 1990.
But still very much higher than most other sectors of the economy.
Exactly.
What is generally the legal status of teacher strikes?
In most states, teacher strikes are illegal. Teacher strikes are illegal in 37 states. However, there's an old labor maxim, show me an illegal strike and I'll show you a failed strike, which is the sense that if you can have enough collective action such that the act of delivering the consequences is unrealistic, then often the legality of the strike itself is less of a question. So that's kind of what we saw in the first wave of Redfred strikes in 2018, when most of the large coordinated strikes were actually taking places in states where teacher strikes were illegal. But the consequences, so the consequences vary across states, but a lot of times it's like fire all the teachers, put the union leaders in jail. And particularly in this moment where we hear states and districts that are really struggling to even find teachers, the likelihood of districts to fire all of their teachers with the idea that they're somehow going to be able to replace them is very, very low. So strike illegality is typically not enough to deter strikes, though there are a few exceptions and, you know, ways you could argue that in some places where the consequences are really enforceable and meaningful, like in New York, the legal status of strikes may really matter.
Now, most of the teacher strikes are too small to appear in the BLS's work stoppage data, right, which covers only activities of 1,000 or more.
Yeah, so we would miss...
You had to assemble a lot of data on your own, in other words.
Exactly. So economists used to study strikes a lot, and it used to be a really generative body of research. And then in the 80s, the Bureau of Labor Statistics stopped collecting data on strikes that involved less than 1,000 workers. And 98.7% of school districts have less than 1,000 teachers employed. So you would miss a huge number of teacher strikes if you were only focusing on that BLS data. And we knew that it wouldn't be viable to have a study only using that BLS data. So what we did was we first got administrative data from the state of Pennsylvania on all the strikes in that state. And then we were able to sort of use that to develop a process by which we could use press releases and media sources to find evidence of teacher strikes in other states. And then in that process, we were able to find a few other administrative data sets and other efforts that we could combine. And we realized that, luckily for us, there's almost always at least a press release letting parents know not to send their kids to school, and then another one saying they can send their kids to school. So we were able to find those articles. It still involved a review of about 90,000 news articles, which sounds insane, but and in some ways it was. It took a long time to do this. I had a team of 7 research assistants, 2 other co-principal investigators, and we reviewed these thousands of articles in order to find evidence of a strike. Now, as soon as we realized this article was not about a teacher strike, we didn't continue to read it. So we didn't have to read every single word of every one of those articles. So a lot of baseball articles in that data set.
That still left a lot of articles to read. So what has the previous research shown on the effects of teacher strikes?
So the previous research that we have is really on strikes in other countries. So there's a really prominent recent study from some really excellent economists who also had an incredible data lift to study teacher strikes in Argentina. And they find negative long-term outcomes for students as a result of experiencing the teacher strikes there. There's major contextual differences for many, many reasons between US and Argentina. One of the biggest ones is the amount of instructional time lost. So in their study, this is Jaume and Willen, the average kid who experiences strike loses 88 days to the strike. 88 instructional days. And we're talking about in the US, the median strike length is 2 days long. And 65% of strikes are less than a week long. So we're really talking about a different phenomenon when we compare to some of these studies that take place in international contexts, which have often focused on really, really long strikes, partly because it's easier to find data. If a strike is really long, then more people are going to know about it. So that was also another reason why we really needed to create a process for developing our own data set of strikes.
I'm speaking with Melissa Arnold-Lyon of the University at Albany. And why do they strike? Is it traditional labor issues, bread and butter stuff, or are there other issues involved?
For the most part, yes. So 89% of strikes have teacher compensation as at least one of the demands of the strikers, mostly teacher salaries. So 81% of strikes have teacher salaries as a demand, 32% have teacher benefits as a demand. These are not mutually exclusive categories. Working conditions are also a pretty prominent demand. So about 60% of strikes or about 60% of strikes focus on working conditions. Usually that's like raising school expenditures or lowering class size. Some demands that people might consider more like student learning conditions or these sort of broader ideas. There's also non-instructional staff comes up in about 16% of strikes. And then we were interested in common good demands because that's been more prominent in some recent strikes, in some of the Red Thread strikes, and also in a high-profile Chicago strike. And we found that only about 10% of strikes have common good demands that would relate to things outside of education-specific policies like housing or immigration.
Now, we've seen a lot of ineffective strikes over the last few decades. How did the teacher strikes measure up? What were the outcomes?
What we find is that strikes really substantially increase annual teacher compensation. The annual increase in teacher compensation reaches about an 8% increase by the fifth year after the strike, which is about roughly $10,000 per teacher. That's compensation, so it's inclusive of salaries and benefits, but a really substantial increase. You don't see it right away. It takes about 3 years to start to really see it, which makes sense given the way that these negotiations sort of pan out within the context of contracts, or also when teachers are negotiating with states, a lot of times they won't bump up the expenditures right away. Teacher strikes also lower class sizes by about half a student over the same five-year time period. And we see that they improve working conditions in other ways. So they increase the expenditures on non-instructional staff compensation. So non-instructional staff could be like nurses or guidance counselors or janitors, cafeteria workers, and they increase expenditures on non-instructional staff compensation by about 7% over the same time period.
And then what about the effects on students?
Right. So the average strike, and remember, we're talking about on average, the median strike is 2 days long. So the average strike has no effect on student achievement in the 5 years where we really have good enough data to be very confident that there's no effect. So we're ruling out even very small positive or negative effects in that period. We can't rule out small positive or negative effects in the long run after that 5 year period. And so we're not really able to estimate what I think some union folks would like us to be able to estimate, which is whether the spending increases, because remember, those are a little bit delayed, whether those then lead to increases in student achievement. There's also an important caveat to this, which is that if we look at the strikes lasting 2 or more weeks, so 10 days or more, we do see that those strikes cause math achievement to decline somewhat, not a major decline, in both the year of the strike and in the year immediately following the strike. But then it goes back in subsequent years, suggesting that the students then catch up.
If I may channel the conservative in the audience, yeah, that's very nice for the teachers. They get higher pay, better working conditions maybe, but there's no effect in the students. And if there's no effect in the students, that's what the schools are all about. Money doesn't grow on trees, so maybe we should just keep paying the teachers pretty poorly if it has no effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think that different people may interpret the results of this study in different ways. So I would say in general, a lot of people, partially because in the U.S. right now, the teachers, partially through strikes, have been able to make a really compelling case that both their salaries and working conditions are not where they need to be. And so right now, the response to this study, which has been exciting to see so many people engaging with the work, the response to the study in general has focused on how strikes increase teacher salaries and how that helps large portion of the American workforce. But I also think it's a reasonable take to focus on how they are increasing expenditures without necessarily increasing the productivity of the teachers themselves. And I think that the one real challenge to coming to that conclusion is just that we wouldn't necessarily expect to see an increase in productivity in that sort of five-year time range where we have the ability to be more precise in our estimates. And so when we do try to look out, you can interrupt me on this one if I'm getting too niche, but school finance reform has been a big area of research for economists over the past 5 or 6 years. There was a big meta-analysis came out this year, and I think the researchers have sort of come to the consensus that you need about 4 years of sustained expenditures per pupil increases of about $1,000 or more in order to see an effect on student achievement. And we wouldn't really expect to see that kind of sustained increase. We don't see that sustained increase in expenditures until about 8 years after the strike. And so we're really limited because we can only look at so many strikes that really have data, student achievement data, that go at least 8 years after the strike. And when we do, we don't have a lot of precision to say one way or the other, but I think our results are not in conflict with that school finance literature.
So to sum that up, it seems that any effects, good effects on the students would be beyond the scope of your data, but you can say with some confidence that the strikes have no negative effect on students.
Yes, at least in the short term,
yeah.
Short and medium term.
But it's hard to imagine how a two-day strike would have any kind of long-term effect on anyone.
Exactly. And especially considering that we see the effect dissipate in the second year after the strike. So it seems to be that if you were concerned about a negative effect, you would expect to see that sustained in the 5 years following the strike. And that's not what we see.
That was Melissa Arnold-Lyon, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the University of Albany and co-author of a new National Bureau of Economic Research working paper on those topics. I just learned via a new report from the Economic Policy Institute and the Center for Economic Policy Research, the pay gap between teachers and other comparable college-educated workers has grown to 27%. It was 6% 3 decades ago. We need to pay our teachers better. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Life as My Teacher by Miss Kitten. Life, of course, is a teacher, but I want to make it clear that we also need professional educators. Till next week, bye.
Life is my teacher. Life is my teacher.